This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
As part of healing the wounds of war, Vietnamese victims of Agent Orange are coming to share their experiences at Portland State University's Multicultural Center, Room 228 in Smith Memorial Student Union. Share their experiences, build solidarity, and help achieve justice for these Vietnamese Agent Orange victims. The event takes place from 7 to 10 p.m. on December 7th. For more information, visit vn-agentorange.org. KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of this event.
KBOO is proud to present Democracy Now!, the award-winning news and public affairs show hosted by Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. Tune in weekdays at 11 a.m. following the KBOO radio zine for Democracy Now! Here on your community radio station, KBOO.
Latino programmers are holding their first annual open house this upcoming Sunday, December 4th from noon to 7 p.m. You are invited to come visit our station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Come down and take a tour of our studios, meet your favorite DJs, enjoy food and live performances, and find out how to get connected here at your community radio station, KBOO. That's the Latino Programmers Open House, Sunday, December 4th, from noon to 7 p.m. at KBOO. For more information, visit our website at www.kboo.fm. We'll see you there.
On January 20, 1999, KBOO was granted a license by the Federal Communications Commission to serve the public interest as a public trustee until February 1, 2006. Our license will expire on February 1, 2006. We have filed an application for license renewal with the FCC. A copy of this application is available for public inspection during our regular business hours. It contains information concerning the station's performance during the last 8 years. Individuals who wish to advise the FCC of facts relating to our renewal application and to whether the station has operated in the public interest should file comments and petitions with the Commission by January 3, 2006. Further information concerning the Commission's broadcast license renewal process is available at Station KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon 97214, or may be obtained from the FCC, Washington, D.C., 20554.
We're proud to be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Fiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Galta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News.
We'll have a report on the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition's Friday rally.
The Senate Armed Services Committee held a closed session on the U.S. military paying for propaganda in Iraqi newspapers.
The U.S. military says 10 Marines and an Army soldier were killed yesterday in Iraq.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,123 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 42,000 others wounded. Among Iraqi civilians, it is estimated that as many as 30,789 people have been killed as a direct result of the war, while the medical journal The Lancet estimated last year as many as 198,000 Iraqi civilians died as a result of the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 2nd, 2005. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Andy C. The Portland Peaceful Response Coalition's Friday rally focuses on three topics: congressional renewal of the USA Patriot Act, Representative John Murtha's call for a withdrawal from Iraq, and immigration reform. On the phone to talk about the PPRC rally, which is now in progress in Pioneer Square, is Will Seaman. Hello, Will.
Hello, Andy.
How are you doing? What's going on down at the square?
Well, of course, it's a little wet and it's a little cold, but we're all keeping warm because of the terrific feeling out here. Of course, we're out here every Friday at 5 p.m., and we've got maybe 20 or so people here, and we're marking today. Of course, we're right now, the Bush administration is coming up against the sunset deadlines on the Patriot Act. These features of the Patriot Act go away automatically at the end of this month, which means they're going to be aggressively pushing for their version of the Patriot Act. So right now, more than ever, we need to be flooding Congress with phone calls demanding that they eliminate these the most egregious features of this what is essentially the war at home, the attack on civil liberties and the Bill of Rights here in the United States.
All right, and what else are you going to be talking about tonight?
Well, this week marked what we think is a gaining momentum, the belated conversion of people in the Democratic Party to the recognition that this war in Iraq, the occupation, has been a catastrophe. It's been a catastrophe, as you've just pointed out, in terms of the casualties among Iraqis, among U.S. soldiers. It's been a catastrophe for this nation, and we're very pleased to see that Nancy Pelosi has, in a sense, reversed her initial response to Murtha's call for withdrawal by herself saying that she supports that call for withdrawal. So we're, of course, marking that very important gain in momentum in Congress among the Democrats, finally coming around to the point of view of most of the people in this country.
All right, and what can you tell me about immigration reform quickly?
Well, you know, whenever a government is faced with the kind of catastrophes and the corruptions that the Bush administration is faced with, they always turn to a scapegoat. That's what we're seeing in terms of this announcement of immigration reform. This is an effort to shift the attention away and to blame people who are trying to find a livelihood by coming to this country, to blame them for the problems, the economic problems faced by people in this country. So, of course, we are standing in solidarity. Tomorrow morning, we're going to be joining with Tikkun and Vos, local organizations that are going to be confronted by these anti-immigration hate groups. And so we're going to be talking about that as well tonight.
Very good. Thank you very much, Will. That was Will Seaman of the Portland Peaceful Response Coalition.
As the nation reaches its 1,000th execution, death penalty critics here in Oregon are concerned about the law's fairness and its dangers. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
In the U.S., since the death penalty was reinstated, took place early this morning in North Carolina. Here in Oregon, that landmark is raising questions about the fairness of the death penalty. Clarence Pugh with the Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty says since 1978, 122 innocent people have been exonerated and freed from death rows in 25 states.
That's 12%. That's a pretty high ratio. Just exactly what number of innocent people would we want to execute in order to exact revenge or retribution?
Pugh says the death penalty cannot be applied accurately and fairly.
There is the chance that people who are innocent will be convicted. There are great risks of doing that.
Currently, there are 33 prisoners facing the death penalty in Oregon. Pugh hopes that the state will opt for life without the possibility of parole and life with a 30-year minimum for aggravated murder. His organization is also urging state lawmakers to reduce the number of categories of aggravated murder and to enact laws that are more compassionate when it comes to criminals with mental problems. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
The Port of Portland proposes to construct a toxic sediment dump along the Willamette River. However, public response has been overwhelmingly opposed. Federal officials are weighing these public comments as they prepare to issue an expected January decision on how best to clean up and dispose of the sediment. The sediment is laced with pesticides, chemicals, and heavy metals. It's from off Portland's Terminal 4 north of downtown. Under consideration by the EPA are four alternatives for cleaning up Terminal 4. That stretch of river is a federal Superfund site. The EPA's preferred option involves constructing an earthen berm at the end of the slip and filling it with contaminated sediment dredged from the river. The poisonous brew was decades in the making, but area residents and environmentalists opposed burying it at Terminal 4. They say that flooding or an earthquake could unleash the toxins again into the Willamette.
Kathy Kelly and the nonprofit group Voices in the Wilderness have spent 9 years agitating for a humane U.S. policy in Iraq. Kelly has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 3 times. She also appeared before a federal grand jury after bringing water and medical supplies to Iraqi civilians against a U.S. embargo that stretches back to the Clinton administration. Kathy Kelly is in town tonight for a lecture at Portland State University, and she joins us now on the phone. Kathy, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for the invitation.
Oh, great. We'd love to have you. We'd like to hear a little bit about your lecture tonight, but first, tell us about your campaign to help free the 4 members of the Christian Peacemaker teams kidnapped in Iraq.
Well, these people are still hostage right now with a very serious threat that December 8th would be a deadline for whether or not they would be released, contingent upon the United States releasing Iraqis who are detained in U.S. and Iraqi prisons. So it is certainly a very troubling time. Important to clarify that these people are not missionaries. They were not over there to proselytize, nor were they spies. The Christian Peacemaker team very bravely wanted to be able to report independently on conditions that people experienced in Iraq under occupation, under bombardment, and certainly with their detainee program, they did their best, and it was an important effort to try to secure from the U.S. military the list, the names of people that were held in prison, and to do advocacy on the part of the many people that were trapped in those prisons, almost kind of out of sight, out of mind. And so it's a high irony right now that they face this terrible dilemma. We encourage people to go to a website, www.freethecpt.org. One small thing to do is to click on that website and sign a petition, but also within communities to hold these people in our hearts and minds, and if anyone has a way to try to extend influence toward their relief, particularly within the communities of our Muslim and Arab brothers and sisters, this would certainly be welcome.
Okay, thanks for that information. Let's turn around and talk about tonight. What will you be talking about tonight, and where will you be speaking?
Well, I am certainly, again, thinking about the idea of people being out of sight, out of mind in our country. You know, one-fourth of the world's prisoners are held in United States prisons and jails, and I recently spent 3 months in prison, had also done a previous 9 months imprisonment stretch, and I want to talk about the comparisons, the very sad comparisons, between Iraq being treated almost as one big prison, people trapped in a terrible situation in Iraq under warfare and under occupation, and some of the insights that I think we can gain from thinking about imprisonment of people in our own country. Do we want to collaborate with the way that the ruling elites in this country are continuing to characterize our society as one that's based on threat and force to solve problems? So it'll be a real privilege to be with people at the Portland State University tonight. And the room is the Millar Library.
Okay.
At 7 o'clock p.m.
Oh, at 7. Okay, great. And finally, can you tell us, people who, you know, may be interested in doing something, what should they be doing to make a change in U.S. policies in Iraq?
Well, I certainly think educating ourselves and our communities is important, but it is the case that for many people who are not of age to be sent over to Iraq to be fighting, I think when we ask ourselves, what does this government want from us and what can we control, we're basically looking at one word that's the same answer for both those questions. What they want is our money, and what we can control is our money. I think many people don't want to pay for weapons and warfare out of their own personal budget. Well, it's very, very difficult to refuse that. So how then can we say, well, look, we're not going to collaborate any further with this government? I think it means coming together and saying, well, what risks do we face? You know, the risks are nothing like what people faced in El Salvador, going up against death squads, going up against possible disappearance. It's nothing like what people faced when they tried to resist Hitler in the few instances when we did see that. But if we don't want to collaborate with the ruling elites who are so endangering the security of this country, it's imperative that we get together in our communities and ask ourselves, what risks can we take to withdraw our consent and our collaboration with the very dangerous policies that are being forwarded by this government.
Okay, thanks so much, Kathy. Really appreciate that. That was Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices in the Wilderness. She's speaking tonight at 7 p.m. in the Miller Library at Portland State University. Admission is free, and cans of food are accepted at the door for the Oregon Food Bank.
Conservationists are tentatively applauding a plan proposed this week by Oregon Representatives Walden and Blumenauer. It would extend the wilderness protections to 75,000 acres on Mount Hood and in the Columbia Gorge. KBOO's Kirk Vanderveer reports.
A plan proposed this week by Oregon Representatives Greg Walden and Earl Blumenauer would extend wilderness protections to 75,000 acres of public land on Mount Hood and the Columbia Gorge. Conservationists are cautiously applauding the plan, but say it leaves out some of the region's most threatened areas. Jay Ward is with the Oregon Natural Resources Council.
It's an important first step in the right direction, although we had hoped they would seize this moment to protect more of the 260,000 acres of remaining wild forest.
Ward said there's no doubt the land the congressman proposed to protect deserves wilderness designation.
It appears they may be leaving out special places like Lost Lake Buttes and Boulder Lake. Those places deserve protection at least as much as the south rim of the Columbia Gorge.
The 75,000 acres is down from 177,000 acres that previous Senate legislation had sought to protect. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Kirk Vanderveer, KBOO News.
Stay tuned for independent Native news following our newscast at 5:30, and at 5:30 it's Counterspin. Then at 6 p.m. here at Bread and Roses. At 7, it's Soul Music of Jay's Place. Tonight's weather, showers, snow level 1,500 to 1,000 feet, lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, showers likely. Snow levels 500 feet, rising to 1,000 feet in the afternoon. Snow accumulation is less than an inch, highs around 40. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Well, the current time is coming up on 18 minutes after 5 o'clock. And now, daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Satire is dead. When a society's reality becomes so inherently absurd that it cannot be satirized, satire is dead. In our society, Pat Robertson's maniacally bloated ego has become the dark hole of absurdity and the death of satire. This Republican televangelist sucks in all surrounding reality, contorting and condensing it to an impenetrable mass of his own pseudo-religious pomposity, which he occasionally spews forth to the faithful as the veritable word of God. Recent spewings have included his call for the assassination of Venezuela's president, his assertion that the State Department would be improved if a nuclear bomb were to explode within it, and his prediction that Orlando would be hit with a meteor because it allowed a gay pride event to take place. Now the apocalyptic absurdist has struck again, this time promising God's wrath on Dover, Pennsylvania. This township recently found itself at the hot center of the campaign by a group of religious creationists to impose their belief in intelligent design on America's science educators. These creationists took over the local school district and, last fall, put their religious notion into the science curriculum. Parents, however, were less than grateful, and this fall, the voters summarily dumped the creationists from office, reinstating old progress, science-based science in the classrooms. Robertson sucked all of this reality into his head, declared that it had infuriated God, and ominously suggested that divine wrath could soon visit Dover. I'd like to say to the good citizens of Dover, if there is a disaster in your area, don't turn to God. You just rejected him from your city. Instead, spaketh Pat, the people of Dover should try praying to Charles Darwin. This is Jim Hightower saying, if secular humanists tried to invent an absurd religious protagonist, they could not in their wildest dreams invent one as absurd as Robertson. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at motherjones.com.
The top lawmaker on the Senate Armed Services Committee held a closed session with Pentagon officials today. They discussed the U.S. military paying Iraqi newspapers to report positive news about the U.S. occupation. The LA Times reported on Wednesday that articles were written by U.S. soldiers and then translated by a defense contractor. Articles omitted information that might reflect poorly on the U.S. military. FSRN's Mitch Jeserich has more from Capitol Hill.
Today, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, John Warner of Virginia, took a trip across the Potomac River to the Pentagon for a classified briefing on recent reports that the U.S. military, through a defense contractor known as the Lincoln Group, is paying some Iraqi newspapers to run pre-written articles that shed favorable light on the military there. Yesterday, Warner expressed deep concern, saying, quote, "A free and independent press is critical to the functioning of a democracy." He also said he was concerned about any actions that may erode the independence of the Iraqi media. Though Warner says he stands by those quotes, after meeting with the Pentagon officials today, he was much more protective of the policy.
We've made a lot of progress in Iraq, and we're continuing to make it. And I'm just hopeful that once this story is out, if there were some wrongs, they'll be addressed. But I hope it will not curtail our ability to get the truth and fact to the Iraqi people.
The Lincoln Group has at least two contracts with the military to provide media and public relations services in Iraq. One of the contracts is for $6 million for advertising work that allegedly involved planting favorable stories in the media. According to the report first put out by the LA Times, those articles were never attributed as being PR pieces, but instead of the appearance of being written by journalists. The Lincoln Group has also another contract that is worth $100 million in Iraq for web and video-based media operations. Senator Warner says that the Pentagon is not yet considering ending such practices.
The reader spoke up on several occasions, as did others, saying that we must do our work of combating this disinformation in a manner that's consistent with our finest traditions of journalism and to maintain the credibility of the United States.
Most of what Congress will learn about the Lincoln Group and its efforts in Iraq will be known only with classified information that will not be made available to the public. Puzzled reporters at today's press conference asked Warner, why would information given to the Lincoln Group to write favorable articles in Iraq be made classified?
And that's the ultimate question you've got to answer. And at this moment, I can't give you any facts to help you on that.
Mitch Jeserich, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
The U.S. military says 10 Marines and an Army soldier were killed yesterday in Iraq. The 10 Marine deaths were caused by a roadside bomb that exploded near Fallujah. The military says the other death occurred in a rocket attack near Ramadi. Both areas are west of Baghdad. All of the Marines were assigned to the 2nd Marine Division. Authorities say the bomb near Fallujah was made from several large artillery shells. In addition to the 10 Marines who died, 11 others were wounded.
Israel carried out a successful test of its missile defense system today. The defense ministry said the Arrow system intercepted and destroyed a missile similar to a long-range Iranian weapon. State-owned Israeli Aircraft Industries and U.S.-based Boeing began developing the Arrow system after Iraq fired 39 Scud missiles at Israel during the 1991 Gulf War. It was the 14th test of the system and the first trial since a failed test firing last year. Israel considers Iran to be its biggest threat, but doesn't believe Tehran's claims that its nuclear program is peaceful.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 2nd, 2005. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please give us a call at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Kirk Vandeveer. Tonight's audio editor is Noah Eaton. Special thanks to reporter Kurt Vandeveer. Our engineer is D.R. Garrett. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Miriam Widman.
And I'm Andy Seaton. Stay tuned for Independent Native News and at 5:30 Counterspin, followed at 6 by Bread and Roses. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, hear Cecil and Celeste host More Talk Radio. Their guest is Glenn Ford of The Black Commentator. At 9, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour with interviews, commentaries, and analysis of current issues. At 10 on Health Watch, Dr. David Naiman speaks with Ellen Cutler, the author of Micro Miracles, Discover the Healing Power of Enzymes. And at 10:30, Scott Forrester hosts Monday on the Environment. And, of course, at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us.
This is Independent Native News for Friday, the 2nd of December. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. A major ice storm and blizzard that hit South Dakota this week has been especially hard on tribal residents. The storm knocked out power to 50,000 homes across the state and snapped off more than 8,000 power poles. Some residents could be without electricity until mid-December. The Yankton Sioux tribe was in one of the hardest hit areas. Tribal officials say they are sheltering between 700 to 1,000 residents. As Charles Michael Ray reports, some tribal residents say more needs to be done.
The Yankton Sioux Tribe has set up an emergency operations center at the Fort Randall Casino. Chairman Robert Knoyer is leading the tribe's recovery effort.
We're doing it to the best of our ability. We're just trying to make sure that we're helping all the right people that need the help.
One tribal resident who says her family was homeless before the storm hit had to abandon the teepee they were living in when the blizzard broke one of the support poles. Frances Zephyr says she's now in a motel that's been paid for by FEMA. She says the tribe needs to do more.
My concern is that the people that are in need, that need these services that are out in the cold, aren't being provided them. And see, they're cutting our people off now.
Tribal officials say they're doing all they can, but admit that more people are in need of help. Chairman Knoyer says emergency personnel are conducting a door-to-door survey to assess the needs of each tribal resident. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
Tribes in the Pacific Northwest are gathering in Seattle this week to talk about the future of gaming in the state. As Jason Parr reports, one speaker, Seattle's county prosecutor, is one of the state's biggest opponents to gaming expansion.
Over the past decade, gambling has boomed in Washington state. It's now more than a $1.5 billion industry. But for the county prosecutor in Seattle, enough is enough. Nora Mailing has opposed further expansion of gambling and is one of the keynote speakers at the Northwest Gaming Law Summit. One of the key issues Mailing is addressing is the request of some to allow different gaming rules for certain tribes. The prosecutor believes relaxing any of the rules would be like letting the genie out of the bottle, as every tribe would want its own set of guidelines. Another issue he's against is a revenue sharing plan which would have tribes and the state sharing profits. Mailing says the state would then have a financial conflict of interest with an industry it regulates. Organizers say other topics to be discussed include off-reservation gambling expansion, as well as a forecast for the tribal gaming industry. From Seattle, I'm Jason Parr.
Four First Nations in Vancouver, British Columbia, have signed an agreement with the organizing committee for the 2010 Winter Olympics. Craig McCulloch reports.
The agreement is officially a statement of principles between the organizing committee for Vancouver's 2010 Winter Olympics and the First Nations communities who will be near scheduled athletic events. The four Aboriginal communities are the Lhuillat, Musqueam, Squamish, and the Tsleil Waututh Nations. The deal is said to be the first of its kind between Indigenous peoples and an Olympic and Paralympic Games. The 12-page document, which was also signed by the Canadian and British Columbian governments, will govern how the four bands will contribute to the Games in terms of cultural exhibitions, developing skills and training, a youth sports strategy, and First Nations involvement in the opening and closing ceremonies. Chief Bill Williams, one of 16 hereditary chiefs of the Squamish Nation in suburban Vancouver, says the agreement gives all First Nations access to the Games.
Because we now have a vehicle. We have something to grab onto to be able to be a participant, a full participant in the Olympics.
Jack Poole, chairman of the board for the Vancouver Organizing Committee for the 2010 Olympic and Paralympic Winter Games, says the First Nations input was an essential part of the planning process.
Very early on in the bid, we made a commitment that we had no interest in winning the right to host the Games if it was going to leave anybody in the community out. And first and foremost was First Nations.
The Native communities involved in the signing started the Four Host First Nations Society in November of last year in support of the Olympics.
I'm Craig McCullough from Vancouver.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Sanosky Chambers Law Firm of Albuquerque, San Diego, Anchorage, Juneau, and Washington, D.C. Defending Native American interests since 1976. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and by the Portland Alliance, the city's oldest alternative progressive newspaper, reporting on issues ignored or distorted by corporate-dominated media and providing a voice for social justice activists, environmentalists, trade unionists, and the progressive community. Information at 503-239-4991 or theportlandalliance.org.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, it's the holiday season again, so many conservatives are concocting stories about how Christmas and Christians are under attack. To listen to the likes of commentators such as Bill O'Reilly and Pat Buchanan, simply using the words Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas amounts to anti-Christian hostility. We'll speak with Salon.com senior writer Michelle Goldberg about the war against Christmas and her article, How the Secular Humanist Grinch Didn't Steal Christmas. Also this week, we'll talk about how a curious story became a talking point for conservative pundits. As the story goes, an African-American Republican was pelted with Oreo cookies in a nasty racist attack, presumably launched by Democrats. But did it actually happen? Baltimore City paper reporter Gotti Dechter decided to find out. He'll tell us about what he discovered. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Well, everybody knows about Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. It's the start of the holiday shopping season. But this year we saw something new. People who were paying attention to the news over the Thanksgiving break got an earful about Cyber Monday, touted as the online equivalent to Black Friday. On Fox News Channel, for example, John Gibson introduced business correspondent Dagan McDowell, who Gibson said doesn't make stuff up. Gibson asked if Cyber Monday really existed, and McDowell responded, quote, absolutely. People get back to work after Black Friday, after the Thanksgiving weekend, and they log on at work or maybe at home, and they start doing some online shopping. Close quote. Trouble is, Cyber Monday actually was a made-up phenomenon. As Business Week reported on November 29th, the Monday after Thanksgiving is historically only the 12th biggest online shopping day of the year. But Shop.org, an association for online retailers, decided that internet businesses needed a marketing hook to help them get a Black Friday-type boost. As Shop.org's executive director told Businessweek, it's not the biggest day, but it was an opportunity to create some consumer excitement. And early sales reports indicate that the ploy was a great success, showing a spike in online sales that day, thanks in large part to the media's willingness to spread the Cyber Monday hype.
With the debate over the Iraq war suddenly reinvigorated in elite circles, it's no surprise that big-time pundits are chewing over the issue. But exactly what they think is worth discussing is a different matter. On NBC's Meet the Press on November 27th, the Washington Post's David Broder set some limits on talking about pre-war intelligence. Quote, this whole debate about whether there was just a mistake or misrepresentation or so on is, I think, from the public point of view, largely irrelevant. The public's moved past that. The public wants to know what we're going to do next in Iraq. Close quote. Well, if you happen to think that the U.S. should withdraw from Iraq, you're out of luck. As Broder said it, Congressman John Murtha's advocacy of withdrawing U.S. troops, quote, certainly crystallized the debate about the possibility of an immediate withdrawal, but that was very quickly rejected, close quote. But as news stories continue to document the White House's mishandling of pre-war intelligence, the pundits continue to insist that's all irrelevant. U.S. News and World Report columnist and CBS reporter Gloria Borger could only roll her eyes at the talk of White House deception. Quote, didn't we live through that argument already? In fact, wasn't that in the Democratic talking points in the 2004 election? Are we still arguing over who lied or did not lie about WMD? close quote. Borger, like Broder, insisted that the public has moved beyond the blame game. But as polls show opposition to the war growing and an increasing public distrust for the White House, maybe the American people haven't given up on discussing the origins of the Iraq War. The pundits, however, are another story.
Right-wing critics have pounded away at the media for suppressing the good news from Iraq. And here on Counterspin, we've reported before on the lengths some media have gone to seemingly placate such critics. The New York Times seemed to have found such a story on November 23rd when reporter John Burns wrote about what he called a symbolic moment, a ceremony at the largest of Saddam Hussein's former palaces where U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad and U.S. General George Casey were officially turning over control of the palace to Iraqi officials. The article's headline read, "Return of Former Palace to Sovereignty of Iraqis Offers Glimmer of Hope." But what little hope there might have been was interrupted by an incoming rocket or mortar shell that sent U.S. soldiers and other attendees diving for cover. Indeed, the picture that accompanied the article depicts a chaotic and decidedly unceremonious situation, with one soldier getting up from the floor and several others scrambling to positions. In the end, Burns' report did seem to get across the point that the symbolic moment was ruined, but not so for the Times headline writer, who seemed to mistake the glimmer of a munitions explosion for a glimmer of hope.
Most people are aware that news media rely on corporate advertising dollars, but the fact is usually obscured, and if they're asked, editors uniformly argue that there's no connection whatsoever between the companies that buy ads and the content of the news. Now would be a good time for U.S. News and World Report to say something like that, lest readers be confused by the December 5th issue, which features a health column about Alzheimer's disease, interspliced with two full-page ads that seem more than coincidentally related. One ad is for an Alzheimer's treatment drug called Aricept. Sometimes it seems that two-thirds of a magazine's ads are for drugs, so if you're inclined to be generous, you might think that was just fortuitous. But the other ad, chosen by U.S. News to run alongside their health column about Alzheimer's disease, is for MetLife, the insurance company, touting not MetLife's insurance, but their foundation's contributions to funding research on Alzheimer's. Obviously, U.S. News thinks going to such lengths to serve a corporate sponsor is good business, but for readers it should provoke serious questions. If advertisers get to work with the magazine on which sorts of stories will show their ad in the best light, what else might they have a say in? Maybe the slant of the stories that run, or even whether stories run at all. Well, it doesn't seem that much of a stretch. Well, one thing the column does is it suggests that Alzheimer's is more likely to strike those who don't continually prod their intellects to learn and expand. Being critical of ad-driven health reporting would be one way to do that.
And finally, more on the increasingly blurry line between the news and the ads. Time magazine's Person of the Year is always a media event covered throughout the corporate press as some sort of significant declaration. This year's announcement will have a new feature, the exclusive sponsorship of the Chrysler Automobile Company. In addition to the print magazine, they'll be sponsoring a CNN documentary on the same issue this month. Advertising Age magazine noted on November 21st that unsavory characters like Adolf Hitler were previous winners, not necessarily the folks advertisers want to be associated with, as they put it. But pretending that Chrysler won't be able to influence the decision is more than a little naive. In 2001, it was reported that Time nearly chose Osama bin Laden as Person of the Year, until retail giant Walmart suggested they wouldn't sell such an issue in its stores. And Time management has not been shy about playing ball with advertisers. Back in 2000, the magazine culminated its Heroes for the Planet series, which was exclusively sponsored by the Ford Motor Company. When asked about the conflict of interest presumed by having an automobile company sponsor an environmental series, Time's international editor admitted that the series wasn't likely to profile environmentalists battling, say, the polluting auto industry. As he put it, "We don't run airline ads next to stories about airline crashes." It's safe to assume those rules still apply.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. We'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. The holiday season is upon us again, and that means America's favorite winter sport, Christmas bashing is here again, too. At least that's the way many prominent conservatives are telling it. To them, when someone hails you with a Happy Holidays instead of a Merry Christmas, well, that's simply anti-Christian hate speech. These declarations are made nightly on cable news, particularly by Fox hosts Bill O'Reilly, John Gibson, and Sean Hannity. On November 30th, the day before this show was taped, all three Fox News anchors hosted segments warning Christians that their sacred day was under attack. The story is even in the mainstream now, with ABC World News Tonight and Good Morning America both airing reports in which ABC reporter Dan Harris asks the question, are Grinches trying to steal Christmas? Michelle Goldberg answers that question in an article headlined, How the Secular Humanist Grinch Didn't Steal Christmas, published on November 21st by Salon.com, where she is a senior writer. Goldberg's upcoming book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, is due out this spring. She joins us now by phone. Michelle Goldberg, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin with a short rundown of this phenomenon. What are these conservatives saying is happening to Christmas?
They're essentially saying that liberals are conspiring, that there's some kind of malign conspiracy between George Soros and various kind of liberal funders, the ACLU and various websites, to put pressure on stores to use the phrase Happy Holidays instead of Merry Christmas. Stores and governments, you know, to call, say, the tree in Rockefeller Center, to call it a holiday tree instead of a Christmas tree. They also will insist that the ACLU is on some kind of mad campaign to sue any school district where kids sing Christmas carols as part of a holiday concert, or where kids, you know, hand out kind of religious-themed Christmas cards to one another. That's entirely false, but that's the myth that's getting propagated.
Well, what's really happening? Is Christmas really under fire?
What's interesting, I mean, no. That's the short answer. This is a trope that kind of recurs from time to time in the far right. It was something that Henry Ford wrote about in his book, The International Jew. It was something that the John Birch Society fulminated about in 1959. In each case, it's interesting. It's the same complaints, essentially, that Jews are trying to take the Christ out of Christmas. Well, let me back up, actually. The Fox News demagogues, they don't say Jews. They say secular humanists or, you know, Christmas-hating liberals or something to that effect. But the story is always that there's this malign group of kind of conspirators who want to strip Christmas of its Christian character, and that usually this is just kind of the wedge of a broader agenda to de-Christianize America.
Give us a couple of recent examples from Fox or from other conservative commentators where they make this allegation that Christmas is under attack.
Well, John Gibson actually has a book, John Gibson is a Fox News anchor, called The War on Christmas, How the Liberal Plot to Ban the Sacred Christian Holiday is Worse Than You Think. And he actually concludes in this book, which I had the pleasure of reading, that this war is not just a war on Christmas, but a war on Christianity. And then last night you had on a kind of fairly typical O'Reilly screed on his radio show where he talked about this very secret plan. He talks about George Soros and Peter Lewis are the far left secular progressive billionaires who have funded, they pour money into the ACLU, they pour money into the smear websites, they buy up a lot of the media time, and he says their goal is they want to change the country from a Christian-based philosophical country. And usually what they trot out are these kind of, you know, pathetically mild examples. I think the one thing that the American Family Association has been harping on lately is that Target is using the kind of apparently blasphemous phrase Happy Holidays, and they won't kind of apologize for it, and this is being interpreted as a, quote, ban on Christmas.
And they're not using the greeting Merry Christmas.
Right, well, I don't think that it's, I mean, I'm sure that people in the individual stores are, as far as I've been able to ascertain, as far as Target says, there's no kind of guidance one way or the other about what people in individual stores should say to customers. It's more just that they've used the phrase Happy Holidays in their advertising.
Well, Happy Holidays, of course, is a more inclusive phrase than Merry Christmas, which only really includes Christians. But in your piece, you actually quote an expert that John Gibson uses in his book about whether or not Christmas really is under siege. What was that about?
Well, that's funny because in the book, you know, John Gibson really kind of praises this guy as somebody, this guy Charlie Haynes from the First Amendment Center, as somebody who can rush in I think he, you know, rush in with ambulances blaring, he says something to that effect, or, you know, with lights blaring when there's one of these kind of Christmas emergencies, when a town goes too far in restricting Christian speech. And let me say, first of all, that some towns have done this. They're not as common as the Christian right would have you believe, but there are instances when a town will, for example, say that a kid can't pass out candy canes in the lunchroom that have Christian messages, or they will try to kind of make the entire thing so secular. And what's interesting is that the reason that they do this is not because the ACLU is going to come after them. It's because they've heard in many cases on right-wing radio, you can't say Christmas anymore unless you're willing to get sued. And these people aren't willing to get sued. And they have a really distorted idea of what is and isn't permissible. And it's not coming from the ACLU because the ACLU, in fact, as Charlie Haynes says, often defends people in cases when their religious speech rights have been trampled. The ACLU actually defended kids in Massachusetts when they were told that they couldn't hand out, you know, candy canes with religious messages, because if you're allowed to hand out any kind of messages, you have to be able to hand out all of them. You can't discriminate for or against religion. And, you know, I think Hayes says, you know, that they get these kind of cases all the time. You know, the ACLU gets these kind of cases all the time. They usually don't get that much attention because there's nobody on Fox News kind of raging about them. And he also said something interesting, is that there's more religion, and he's someone who goes to these school districts, you know, spends all of his time traveling around the country. And he said to me that there's more religion now in public schools than ever in modern history.
Well, finally, you suggest that anti-Semitism is not a key factor in all this, but we've seen some troubling signs. Bill O'Reilly, who has said, quote, Hollywood and a lot of the secular press is controlled by Jewish people, close quote, once told a Jewish caller to his radio show who complained about the extreme dominance of Christmas and Christianity. O'Reilly said, quote, you have a federal holiday based on the philosopher Jesus, and you don't want to hear about it? Come on. If you're really offended, you got to go to Israel then, close quote. What's your response to that sort of talk?
What I would say is, you know, and actually I wrote that they weren't explicitly anti-Semitic before I read his latest kind of diatribe about the, quote, secret plot. I guess I would say that, you know, in the past, Henry Ford, there was no question that he was anti-Semitic and that these kind of conspirators he was talking about were the Jews. Since then, the kind of rhetoric is the same, but the villain has become a little bit more slippery. So what I say, I would say that O'Reilly is not necessarily anti-Semitic, not that he isn't anti-Semitic, in that he's not kind of parroting Nazi rhetoric. He is more kind of using the same rhetoric that people have always used against the Jews, but now often kind of inserting secular humanists or secular progressives in their place. And he's also doing something else, which is when he talks about, you know, you've got to go to Israel, he's saying this is a Christian nation and kind of demanding this affirmation from all around, from Target, you know, from stores. He wants this constant affirmation that this is indeed a Christian nation. And, you know, Jews can live in it, but they just have to know their place. You know, minorities can live in it and they'll be tolerated, but they just have to, you know, they have to realize that they're not really part of it. So it's a different kind of, I guess, prejudice than we've seen in the past. It's a slightly different variant of, if it's anti-Semitic, it's a little more elliptical.
It's a new kind of Christian nationalist PC.
Well, that's why I call it Christian nationalism in my book, because it's essentially this ideology that America was founded to be a Christian nation, and now we need to have this kind of restoration.
We've been speaking with Michelle Goldberg. Her article, How the Secular Humanist Grinch Didn't Steal Christmas, can be read at Salon.com, where she is a senior writer. And look out for Goldberg's upcoming book, Kingdom Coming, The Rise of Christian Nationalism, due out this spring. Michelle Goldberg, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you so much.
Some stories, it's often said, take on a life of their own. This next story is a prime example of what happens when a too-good-to-be-true tale lands in the laps of right-wing pundits and columnists. Michael Steele, an African-American Republican politician in Maryland, was apparently the target of a nasty racist stunt, with Democratic partisans lobbing Oreo cookies at him during a debate. It sounds incredible, for sure, which is why one might want to check out and make sure it ever happened. We're joined now by a reporter who did just that. Gadi Dechter is a reporter for the Baltimore City Paper, and he joins us now on the phone. Gadi Dechter, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks very much.
Now, for people who don't know this story, set the stage for us. It happened quite a while ago, but it's been getting a lot of attention in the last few months. What exactly happened here?
In 2002, there was a gubernatorial debate at Morgan State University, which is an historically black university in Baltimore. The debate was between the Republican candidate Robert Ehrlich, who won the election, and the Democratic candidate Kathleen Kennedy Townsend. And what happened at that debate was reportedly a rather raucous and rowdy debate. And the story that emerged from the debate was that Oreo cookies were thrown or brandished or distributed throughout the crowd as a racist taunt against the Republican candidate for Lieutenant Governor Michael Steele, who was black. And various reports of that story came out in 2002 in newspapers. Different variations of the story came out. Sometimes the story was reported as a claim made by either then-candidate Ehrlich or his spokesman, Paul Shurick. And sometimes it was reported as a fact without any attribution or any indication of what the source for the story was.
And the story sort of come back now because Steele is running for the Senate, correct?
Steele's running for Senate, and so there have been other instances in the past. More recently, he was caricatured on a internet website. The photograph of him was doctored up to look like a minstrel character.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happened, there was some media attention to it, and the campaign, both Steele's campaign for Senate and the current Ehrlich administration, and also the National Republican Party, have raised the issue as a pattern of perceived racial insults lobbied against Steele.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as part of that pattern, they bring up again this Oreo cookie story.
Now, the more recent accounts of this seem to have one thing in common, is that they've agreed on the term pelted, that he was actually pelted with Oreos. A spokesperson for the governor's office said that it was raining Oreos. They were thick in the air like locusts. The challenges to this story, the questions raised about whether or not it ever happened, kind of came much later, though, didn't they?
Right. They only came up recently, a few weeks ago, in a Baltimore Sun story by political reporter Andy Green, who wrote a story about the governor's reaction to emerging claims by people on, or to emerging claims by various commentators in, mm-hmm. in the market questioning the veracity of the Oreo cookie-throwing story. And in that story, Andy Green interviewed people who were at the debate who said that they didn't see any Oreos there. He also interviewed Paul Shurick, the spokesman for the governor, who said, quote, that you just repeated, mm-hmm. that the air was thick with them like locusts, that it was raining Oreos.
This wasn't exactly an obscure event, so there were a lot of reporters on hand at the debate, and you would think it would be curious that no reporters at the time noticed that the lieutenant governor, or the candidate for lieutenant governor, was being pelted with Oreos.
Right. I think it was Shurick's claim, this characterization of the air being thick like locusts with Oreos, that was so literally incredible that it got other people's attention to look at what actually happened. One of the things that the Baltimore Sun story did was track the way in which the story has changed over time. And when I read it, I was interested in taking a look at which papers had reported which versions of the story, and discovered that it's true that the characterizations of this story have changed over time, but I also couldn't find any instance where the actual existence of the Oreos was ever independently confirmed, or whether there was any eyewitness account of the Oreos ever being there, except as a claim made by the campaign itself.
Now, the story was probably most aggressively pushed by the Washington Times, but one of the most useful things you did in your piece was to run down some of the pundits who've cited some variant of this story as fact, and you asked them to substantiate what they'd written. What did they base this on? How did those folks respond to your questions?
Well, both reporters and columnists gave the same type of response when I was able to get them on the phone or get them to respond to an email query. Commonly, people would say that they didn't remember where they got. A lot of these stories were written, I mean, particularly the people who wrote the stories in 2002, 2003, would say that they didn't remember where the claim came from. Other people said that they relied on previously published reports. So, you know, an interesting example is in 2002, the London Daily Telegraph, which was one of the first reported accounts of the Oreo cookies being thrown at Steele. David Rennie, reporter for the Daily Telegraph, writes that that Michael Steele was bombarded with Oreo mm-hmm. cookies. When I asked him where he got that information, he said, well, he wasn't at the debate, but that he got it from a United States paper. He thought the Washington Post. The only Post story that had mentioned the incident previous to David Rennie's Telegraph story was a story that attributed to Ehrlich a claim that Oreos were brought to the debate, not thrown.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how the, you know, David Rennie, he neither carried the attribution over into his story, and also the story itself seemed to change. It is clear, though, that the Ehrlich campaign, from reporters that I spoke to who were there at the time, that the story that Oreos were there and that they were thrown or distributed was a claim made by the Ehrlich campaign that night.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't reported until a few days later in a column by George Will in the Washington Post.
It almost seems like a game of telephone. You have these accounts changing suddenly over time and then sometimes changing quite dramatically. There was, as you pointed out, a Chicago Sun-Times columnist who suddenly changed it, and it was a group of black people who pelted the stage, which I think by your account was the first time that new fact was introduced into this story.
Yeah, it's interesting to look at the way that the audience or the people who supposedly threw Oreos are described. Initial reports just have it in the passive tense that that Oreo cookies were distributed, and then it becomes steel bashers in a Washington Times editorial of October this year. Steel bashers threw Oreo cookies. Chicago Sun-Times columnist Mary Mitchell reports that it was a group of black people. So the San Diego Union Tribune editorial of November 7 this year, it was Democratic supporters pelted steel. Our own conservative columnist for the city paper, for my paper, in November 2nd of this year, wrote that some partisans at the debate brought Oreo cookies. So it does change over time.
And he did mention that his sources for this were so numerous that he couldn't feel the need to cite sources.
Right. I mean, it's important to note that the incident has been reported as fact, not just by columnists, though columnists for newspapers are you know, when they are reporting a fact, the newspapers typically require them to report it as any journalist would report a fact to be able to confirm it. But it's not just columnists or pundits. The Washington Post reported in September of this year in a news story that supporters of Lieutenant Governor Kathleen Kennedy Townsend threw Oreo cookies at Steele. So, and it has also reported in the AP that Oreo cookies were brought to the debate or passed around at the debate.
Well, it's a well-traveled tale, and certainly one that we're glad you wrote about. We've been speaking with Gotti Dechter. He's a reporter for the Baltimore City Paper. You should read his story. It's called Cookie Monster at citypaper.com. Gotti Dechter, thanks for joining us this week here on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin. Like a beast in the night.
dich bin vogelfrei.
Es ist schön, dich zu sehen. Komm, reich mich deine Hand. Auch wir sind hier geboren und trotzdem fremd in diesem Land.
Good evening. This is Bread and Roses on KBOO 90.7 FM. This is your weekly Women's News and Public Affairs show. We opened with the Sisters Keepers, and the theme for tonight is Afro-German women. But before I get into the show, I want to do a couple other things. One is I want to announce our underwriter. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center, offering community space, events, gifts, and tools for the revolution. A comprehensive collection of women's writings and more, located at 3734 Southeast Hartorn and on the web at, in other words, books.org. And I also want to announce, because I'm so excited about it, that the Portland Pilots soccer women beat Penn State in it was 0-0 even in overtime, but then they beat 1-0 with a penalty kick, and that will mean they will enter the final game on Sunday morning either against Florida or UCLA. So hopefully the Portland Pilot soccer women will be the champion, but we'll see about that on Sunday. And as I said in the beginning, we will talk about Afro-German women, and we will air excerpts from a reading by Ika Hugel Marshall. And before we start, I'd like to say a little bit about her. Ika Hugel Marshall was born in 1947 in a Bavarian village to a white German woman and a black U.S. soldier. They later returned to the United States before Ika was born. Until the late 50s, the state automatically was in charge of children born out of wedlock in Germany. So when Ika was born, when Ika was six, the state welfare workers convinced her young and stigmatized mother that it would be better for the child to grow up in a children's home. The home was run by Pentecostal nuns who systematically, psychologically, and physically abused her. She did not meet other Afro-Germans or her father in the United States until she was in her 30s. Her path to finding herself was very much inspired through her friendship with Afro-American author Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde taught creative writing in Berlin in 1984 and was the catalyst for an emerging Afro-German movement. The reading you will hear in a minute is from Ika Hugel Marshall's book, Invisible Woman, Growing Up Black in Germany. The reading was at the University of Portland a few weeks ago. The translator, actually you will mostly hear the translator, and that is Dagmar Schulz, who is an editor for Orlando Women's Publishing House and also Ika's partner. So I left some of Ika's original speaking in German at the beginning, but then I edited it out for the sake of time. But there's some places where she speaks in herself in English, but most of it will be through the translator. The N-word is used at different times throughout the reading, as a reference to what Ika was called as a child. And I guess without further ado, why don't we go to the reading by Ika Hugel Marshall from her book Invisible Woman, Growing Up Black in Germany.
We were fighting our battles.
Ja, ich begrüße alle recht herzlich.
Well, I greet you all.
Ich danke der Universität auf Portland, mich eingeladen zu haben.
And I thank the University of Portland for having invited me.
Es ist mir immer eine besondere Freude, in dem Land meines Vaters aus meinem Buch zu lesen.
It is always a special of special meaning to me to read in the country of my father.
Und es macht mir deshalb auch so viel Spaß und Freude, weil es doch viele andere Afrodeutsche gibt, deren Väter auch aus den USA sind und die nie ihre Väter kennengelernt haben.
And I enjoy it especially because there are so many other Afro-Germans whose fathers come from this country but who never had the chance of getting to know their fathers. Yeah, I will begin now. It happened again just the other day. Berta burst through the door with a long-awaited letter from her father in her hand, and I was reminded of how much I wanted to find my father. I'd have liked to see him once from a distance. Sorry for the little technical glitch there. We will start the reading again. This is KBO 90.7 FM, Bread and Roses, and we're listening to Ika Hugel Marshall's translator reading from her book Invisible Woman Growing Up Black in Germany. We seem to have a little trouble. So bear with me, hopefully we can get the CD running.
Deutsche, das hat uns alle lieben wollen, kannst du nicht verstehen. Willst du nicht Gottes Weg nehmen? Du kannst mich ermorden, aber ich werd leben, Gott segne.
Adriano,
RDS da oben, auf den neuen Morgen, wir sind deine Reinkarnation.
Alle recht herzlich.
Well, I greet you all.
Aber ihr seht nicht, ihr fühlt, aber ihr fühlt nicht. Dies geht an die Masken auf der Maskerade.
Ist es wirklich der Sinn? Alle streben, fragen sich schon Milliarden Leute. Und es gerade heute. Minuten verrinnen, verwandeln sich in Jahre, in denen ich eigentlich schon immer handeln wollte. Wirklich wie von Taranteln, hochgesteckt, Ziele hochgesteckt. Mit der späten Einsicht Realität hab ich schon gecheckt. Doch alles Heulen und Zaudern nützt nichts. Was schützt dich außer Verlässlichkeit von selbst? Auf Freundschaft schützt dich. Glücklichen Zustand, abstrakte Erscheinung. Unglück oft Ergebnis zwischenmenschlicher Verpeilung. Verwechselt mit finanziellen Engpässen. Die Raten für dein Auto werden dich und deine Seele wegfressen, weil entweder bist du gefangen im Taumel des Systems, in dem dein Ego von Kreditkarten baumelt, oder verwirklichst dich später in das Traumwelten, der lebendige Vögel wieder auferstehen und kein Baum fällt. Das ist dir und deiner Clique peinlich. Meine Wörter sind nicht Musik, Videokanal tauglich, und das weiß ich. Doch fleißig folgen die meisten lieber vorgegebenen Werten, egal wie sie sich selbst erschwerten. Sehnten sich nach der Stadt, die es nicht wirklich gibt, in der es traurig ist, weil niemand dich wirklich liebt und jeder geschockt wäre über ein selbstloses Opfer. Cocktailpartys mit lebenden Toten.
Ja, ich begrüße alle recht herzlich.
Well, I greet you all.
Ich danke der Universität of Portland, mich eingeladen zu haben.
And I thank the University of Portland for having invited me.
Es ist mir immer eine besondere Freude, in dem Land meines Vaters aus meinem Buch zu lesen.
It is always a special, special meaning to me to read in the country of my father.
Und es macht mir deshalb auch so viel Spaß und Freude, weil es doch viele andere Afrodeutsche gibt, deren Väter auch aus den USA sind und die nie ihre Väter kennengelernt haben.
And I enjoy it especially because there are so many other Afro-Germans
whose fathers come from this country but who never had the chance of getting to know their fathers. Yeah, I will begin now. It happened again just the other day. Berta burst through the door with a long-awaited letter from her father in her hand, and I was reminded of how much I wanted to find my father. I'd have liked to see him once from a distance.
Ja, ich begrüße alle recht herzlich.
Well, I greet you all.
Ich danke der Universität auf Portland, mich eingeladen zu haben.
And I thank the University of Portland for having invited me.
Es ist mir immer ja, eine besondere Freude, in dem Land meines Vaters aus meinem Buch zu lesen.
It is always a special, of special meaning to me to read in the country of my father.
Und es macht mir deshalb auch so viel Spaß und Freude, weil es doch viele andere Afrodeutsche gibt, deren Väter auch aus den USA sind und die nie ihre Väter kennengelernt haben.
And I enjoy it especially because there are so many other Afro-Germans whose fathers come from this country but who never had the chance of getting to know their fathers. Yeah, I will begin now. It happened again just the other day. Berta burst through the door with a long-awaited letter from her father in her hand, and I was reminded of how much I wanted to find my father. I'd have liked to see him once from a distance, no more. I had his name and an old address on a scrap of paper, but that was all. I had been told that wasn't nearly enough information to track down a person in the United States. I didn't even know if he was still living. The idea that I might not find him alive, only his gravestone, actually seemed more plausible to me than the possibility I would ever meet him face to face. I tried to ignore the other possibility, that he might not want to see me, might deny or disown me, even if he were alive, but that anxiety was there too. At my age, what did I want from a father anyway? Hadn't I survived all those years without him? Men, and therefore fathers, were more or less dispensable as role models, or so the women's movement in my country had led me to believe, and it certainly wasn't worth pining for them. That's what the women's movement taught me. How then could I wish for a father? There are many people who have never known their fathers, and some who say they don't feel they missed out on anything. On the contrary, they hardly noticed the lack. My father is black, and for that reason I could not share such feelings. The color of my skin binds me to him. I long believed that bond wasn't strong enough to justify my missing him or undertaking the arduous process of finding him. Germany is my homeland. I've never learned to love it, but I can have no other homeland, no other country, no language. I know my father could never provide me that. Indeed, the very word father, so commonly invoked, triggers a sharp pain in me every time I hear it. But I do want to know who I am. My mother and I were born in the same small town in Bavaria, she in 1925, I in 1947. She was tall and slim back then, with brown hair and blue eyes, the youngest of 11 children of a respectable working-class family. Her father died when she was 10. At 14, she was already working as a housekeeper in a residential section of Munich, although she had been a good student. Because of finances, further schooling was not an option for her. On September 12, 1944, when the so-called fraternization ban was announced, my mother was 19. According to this regulation of the occupying armies, Allied soldiers were strictly forbidden from visiting German homes, accompanying Germans to dance halls, sporting events, or other public functions, and from marrying German women. All Allied contact with Germans was rigorously overseen. These measures were implemented in an attempt to protect the Allied forces from the populace of a nation that had instigated a murderous war. Any contact between the occupying forces and German citizens was considered dangerous and raised suspicions of espionage. It was to be avoided at all costs. Soldiers were constantly forewarned in print and on the radio against such fraternization, especially with women or girls. The withholding of friendly contact was also intended to remind Germans of their responsibility for the crimes of their fascist government. The fraternization ban had further implications for the African-American soldiers of the U.S. Army. The inherent racism of the army conformed with prevailing prejudices of the Germans. Thus, even in the absence of the Allied ban on fraternizing with the enemy, the racism of the Germans would have prevented black soldiers from mixing with German society. In a sense, then, there was a double ban in place against the black GIs. For once, their fellow allies and the Germans agreed on something, discriminating against blacks. Regardless of this, black American soldiers in Germany adhered at least as little as their white compatriots to the rules of the ban. In fact, they were known to be especially kind to children and generous in distributing any excess cigarettes, food, or clothing available to them. In May 1945, after the war in Europe was over, the rules forbidding soldiers from being in the company of Germans were relaxed. And in October 1945, all but two of the regulations provisions were lifted, those against visiting German households and marrying German women. German women who subsequently entered into relationships with American soldiers were called Ami, or American, Hurs, or Ami sweethearts by other Germans. Those who had contacts with black soldiers were called Nigger Hurs. My parents met in 1946, when my mother was almost 21 years old. They saw each other in secret, since after the war, just as before, their biracial relationship was considered immoral by Germans, a violation of racial purity. Now and then, when they had the courage, my parents went out for walks in the park. "Hey, Ami sweetheart, nigger hua." Who would choose to endure being called such things in public? And so eventually they began to meet at a friend's house, and they continued to meet always at the same place for 8 months. They hid themselves away from family and outside world, but every time they parted, they had to leave their happiness and passion behind. My father was 28 and a corporal. In November 1946, after he recovered from an illness, the army sent him back to the U.S. Both of them knew my mother was pregnant at the time, but she had no idea he was being restationed until after he was gone. I was born in March 1947. My arrival was quietly, anxiously celebrated within my mother's family, but the rest of society had long since made up its mind to exclude me and my mother from the fold. When I was one, my mother married a white German man, and a year later my younger sister was born. The next 5 years of my life were relatively trouble-free. There was only one reality, one truth. Everyone was white, and all children looked exactly like their parents. And so I imagined that I must be white too. What else could I be? It was a long time before I really looked into a mirror. In those days, though I understood that there were good and bad things, and friendly and unfriendly people, I hadn't yet learned to divide the world into black and white. On March 19, 1952, 7 years after the war ended and a few days after my 5th birthday, the following article appeared in a German news magazine under the headline, "What will become of the 94,000 occupation babies?" This is a quote now. "This problem has been cast by the leadership party as primarily a problem of the occupation. But it is not just a German problem. It has become an international one and will expand right along with the numbers of peacekeeping forces, just as long as the soldiers of one nation are stationed in the territories of another. At this time, the number of occupation babies is roughly 94,000, including about 3,000 children of mixed race. The numbers have recently tapered off to some extent, but even so, such statistics must give a nation like Germany pause." I was 5 years old and had no idea that for most of the people in my country, I would never grow up. I would remain an occupation baby forever. And a quote, Particular humanitarian and racial problems are presented by one subset of these occupation babies, the 3,093 children of mixed Negro blood. The responsible authorities at the appropriate agencies and the Department of Children's Services have long deliberated over what the fate of these mixed-race children should be. Among other concerns, there is the fact that they are ill-suited to the climate here. I was 5 years old and had no idea that the name of my mother had given me meant nothing to other people. They would call me Neger Mischling, mixed-race Negro, instead. And the quote continues, "The solution to the problem of these mixed-race children is of great concern to us as they are detested by Europeans and blacks alike. I was 5 years old and had no idea that I presented the people of my country with a moral and humanitarian problem." And quote again, "The beginning of their school years is, for Mischling children, more than just the onset of a new stage of life. This is the time when they step from the relative isolation of their previous existence and into a new arena in which the color of their skin makes them stand out. Some exhibit behavioral problems. Those experienced with children will be aware of how intolerant children can be of anything that falls outside the norm. Parents, teachers, and indeed all of us have a particular duty in this regard. I was 5 years old and had no idea it would turn out not to be I who presented problems for others, but they who presented them for me. After 8 months of primary school, I was sent to a Christian children's home far away from where my family lived. The home was administered by the Pentecostal Society and the Independent Protestant Association. As grounds for my institutionalization, the Youth Services Department cited expected problems with my personal and professional development if I remained with my family and grew up in the small town where I was born. Erica, my mother called, you like playing with other children, don't you? Oh, yes. And would you like to travel to another city for a few weeks to stay at a house full of children? Just for 6 weeks, and then I'll come pick you up. Okay, I say, although the words, just for 6 weeks, and then I'll come pick you up, have something vaguely threatening about them. Something frightening. I heard doubt and trepidation in my mother's voice. It sounded more like she was pleading with them than in arranging a wonderful opportunity for me. Time passes, and I don't know for sure whether 6 weeks are up. I'm so afraid of the beatings that come whenever I say something wrong or ask a question that I'd rather keep silent than ask. Worst of all, it slowly occurs to me, somewhere deep down, that I will no longer be welcome, that I cannot go home. But I don't ask questions, maybe out of fear that I wouldn't be able to bear the answers. It takes me a long time to absorb that I'm perceived as different from everyone around me, and a long time to absorb that this difference is something bad. But eventually I do absorb it. It doesn't help when the occasional lady on the street, who calls herself my auntie, gives me a bit of chocolate and says, "You poor, poor thing." My otherness is irrefutably proven whenever I'm impolite or naughty. I'm called little devil or unmanageable creature and told that I lack intelligence. I'm a creature of base instinct. That's the Negro in her coming out, they say. When Sister Hildegard goes at me with her paddle, she says, "I'm not beating you, I'm beating the devil inside you." She refuses to acknowledge her responsibility for my pain. She never says, "Be brave, be strong." Childhood is when we learn how to understand the world, and the way I learn to estimate my own value at the home will determine how I think and behave for a long time to come. I learn that a lie becomes the truth as soon as someone believes it. I learn from whites that I cannot trust them. But the most disastrous thing I learn at the home is self-hatred. The nuns systematically go about dismantling my personality, and I help them do it. I despise myself in an attempt to make myself more acceptable to them.
So now I try in English. Now I'm 60 years old, and I visit my family, and we and I went with my sister for the first time to a disco.
Disco? Mm-hmm.
Lisa and I share everything that siblings share, everything that is but a father. He was hers alone. One Saturday night, we decide to go out to the local disco together. I have never been to a disco. We drink orange juice while Lisa's friends drink beer. They chat and gossip with each other about school, jobs, and what their various friends are up to. I have nothing to say. I know no one and have no idea what I could contribute to the conversation, so I keep quiet. Every once in a while, I look to Lisa for help. And then one of the others asks her, in a voice so loud and clear, I suspect the entire disco hears it, "So, is she your friend, Lisa?" My sister sets her glass on the table with a shaky hand and without looking at me says, "Yeah." Her "yeah" cuts me to the quick. She has just denied that I'm her sister.
So now I make a big step now. I'm 39 years old, and this was the time when I met for the first time other Afro-Germans.
This new sense of having a community has empowered me and strengthened my personality. The changes in me don't go unnoticed by my white friends. "So, are you reading a lot of black literature these days? I've heard that's the newest thing. And what do you know about all that cultural criticism? Can you make heads or tails of it? Maybe you could give me a few pointers." "Oh, but you're not really that black, really, exactly. I've known you so long, I don't even see it anymore. You could actually pass as an Italian, you know. Just be glad you weren't born with a handicap and that you were able to learn a profession. There are plenty of people in the world worse off. What do you think you're going to do now? Go to America just because there are more blacks over there? Well, all the blacks in America are criminals. And you say your father's there, but do you really know that? What do you want with him anyway? It's pretty obvious he doesn't want anything to do with you." Step by step, I begin to discover who I am. In the meetings with my brothers and sisters, I'm set free from the self-doubt and pain, some of which is on the surface, some of which has long been buried, that whites created in me and ultimately trained me to feel, all the while accusing me of hypersensitivity. I'm able to believe in myself, to take myself seriously, and to unlearn much of what whites have taught me.
Yeah, and then in 1990, I went for the first time to the United States.
It finally happens in 1990. After 9 years of Taekwondo training, I go to America. Four other women and I are on our way from Germany to Columbus, Ohio, where we will take part in a week-long training camp, at the end of which I will compete for my black belt. I'm so nervous, I feel my heart may burst as the plane approaches New York City. This is my father's country. Does that make it mine? My whole body trembles. It's as if I were actually about to meet him. How in the world will I manage to get off this airplane in one piece? As I disembark, this anxiety and an overwhelming feeling of longing for my father overtake me. Everything seems out of kilter, even those things that were more or less in order just moments before. In the airport, every mature black man I see is my father. I barely speak English, but I want to run up and start talking to any or all of them. I'm too shy to actually do it. I could just walk up to them, stand before them and say nothing, but what kind of person would do that? Then, before we've gotten far into the airport, several black people nod and smile or say hello to me. I don't know how to respond. Where I come from, only people who are already acquainted greet each other in public. This friendliness, this phenomenon of being seen and acknowledged by people I don't even know, this tacit connection to other blacks, all touch me in precisely the place where my longing for membership in a group and deliverance from isolation reside. I am dazed, but I return their greetings, hoping that this will go on and on all day long. "Do you know them?" asks my training partner. No, I say rather proudly, but I know why they are greeting me. She shakes her head, probably thinking I've gone crazy. It's high summer and the air is so humid I can barely breathe when we land in St. Croix. I've been looking forward to this trip for a long time. Gloria Joseph and Audre Lorde are there to meet us at the gate with a bottle of champagne to celebrate my earning the black belt. It takes forever for our suitcases to appear on the baggage carousel. And while we wait, I look around with curiosity. Everywhere there are black people. For the first time, I'm counting how many whites there are in a room full of blacks.
Okay, I'm back in Germany.
I pick up the receiver. Ika? Sarah? Ika, I found your father. I leap up from the covers and take a deep breath. No, it's impossible, I say. No, really? How? Are you certain? Ika, you won't believe it. I found him in the phone book. He was the only Eddie with IE. I'm out of my mind, then completely nonchalant, then once again stunned as I pace back and forth in the room. Ika, are you still there? Listen, I called him and asked if he had been in Germany between 1945 and 1946 and whether he was stationed in a small town between Munich and Nuremberg. He said yes. Then I asked him if he ever lived at 4959 Prairie Avenue. He said yes before we bought our house on 57th Street. And then I told him he had a 46-year-old daughter in Germany. Every hour, every minute, every second with my family is full of warmth and love. I'm overwhelmed by the unrestrained welcome and also by the fact that my friend Dagmar as a white woman is also accepted by my family. These feelings are somewhat subdued by my exhaustion, however. My father smiles cautiously. Our eyes meet again and again. I see similarities between us that are so remarkable it makes me dizzy. We don't talk a lot because words could not begin to express what we're feeling. Corinne, my father's wife, brings out photo albums and shows me aunts and uncles, my nieces and nephews. All of them are black. Only on one page do I find a single white face, my mother's. So even she has been included in this family album. I'm more than moved. I blush deeply. I'm encountering human kindness and love here, the likes of which I've never experienced before. I wonder if such a meeting as this would be possible in my country, if Afro-Germans who were adopted and raised in the U.S. would receive a comparable welcome.
It was 7 months later, in 1994, 6th of May, my father died. And I wrote some pieces for him. To my family and to my father, I'm very sorry not to be able to mourn Dad's death together with you all. Yet even though I am in Berlin, thousands of miles away, my heart and my love are still with you. To you, my family, I want to say, you met me with love and trust, and this trust made me very happy. Dear Dad, to you who decided that you wanted to pass to rest, I want to say, I love you. You know, it isn't how long people know each other, but what they have to say and to give to each other that matters. Certainly, I have just found you, learned to love you, and it was not much time we had together, but enough to know you took me into your heart as you did your other children. You understood how much I needed you. You know how much I longed to get to know my black father. For 46 years, I had found against being destroyed by white people, not let them take my humanity away. I found you and I was compensated for all the humiliation and struggles. I found you and I knew that my survival in a white racist society was not for nothing. I found you and I felt that what whites say about blacks is not true and only serves to oppress us. I found you and I felt stronger in doing my part to force white society to give us the respect we deserve. I found you and was full of fear and caution. You stretched out your hand and put your heart around me. Meeting you healed me and gave me strength to walk straight and with proud through this world. I found you and I will never lose you again. On June 11, 1996, it happens, I'm granted American citizenship. My father would have been overjoyed to hear the news, but he left me a family, brothers and sisters, and they celebrate with me afar. I was 7 years old when my mother left me alone at the home, and it hurt me infinitely. I never really learned to bear being away from home, where I was safe, where I belonged. I was panicky and fearful the whole way there, to the children's home. I was afraid I would never come home again. I never did, except on and off for the holidays. That pain is a lifelong one. Today, my mother is 72 years old, and her curly brown hair is one full with gray. We have both grown older, leading our separate lives. Memories remain. It hurt to be sent away from her and to exchange security for physical and psychological violence. But even today, it's hard for me to be angry with my mother. She is the only one in the world who truly belongs to me, who is with me, even now. I have long since forgiven her, and she has long since asked for my forgiveness. Although my birth brought unspeakable humiliation upon my mother, I remember feeling nothing negative, not being hit, not being treated dismissively, not being unloved. She did not send me away to the home because of any shortage of love for me. My sister Lisa is 48 years old now. She has dark brown hair and has been married since the age of 24. She has a 21-year-old son and a 17-year-old daughter. Much to my surprise, Lisa came to Berlin a few days before my 50th birthday. She helped with preparations for the party and got to know many of my friends. She was especially glad to meet other Afro-German women, for I was the only one she had ever known. One night, when we were eating dinner with a small group of friends, a remarkable discussion took place. One of my white friends asked Lisa what it had been like to have a black sister, what experiences she remembered, how she had felt. And for the first time, Lisa spoke about this subject, which had been unmentionable. She said that she too was branded as the daughter of a nigger whore, and that she had often been reminded of it by people she knew and by her husband's family. She told us that her wedding and reception had almost been cancelled because they learned she had invited me. She talked about how often she had been reminded of our mother's conduct, sometimes subtly, sometimes directly. She talked about how long she had had to hold in her rage, her feelings of helplessness and her grief, and how conflicted she had been. Her only comfort, she said, was the unconditional love of her children. I was glad and relieved to learn at last about her anger and her sorrow, and that she was afraid of hurting me with her feelings, even if it was rather late in the coming. Lisa and I had never in all those years been able to tolerate each other's anger, much less express it. That night we moved a step closer. I have everything today. My life, my longings, my love, a light-hearted happiness, humor, respect, and pride in myself. Every morning I look forward to the coming day and experience the world anew. I look in the mirror and I'm happy, for there's nothing in the world I want to be but myself.
We call ourselves Afro-Germans or Black Germans, and that has been taken on by society. There's also a growing multicultural community, not just Black Germans, who make up a small part of that, but there's a large immigrant population, and that does make a difference. Change in consciousness is the most difficult path. You know, it's easier to demonstrate or to boycott, but to change people's consciousness is very difficult. even if it's just a couple of people who come along and say, I want to change something about my life, that's worth it. And that she feels that there are quite a number of white Germans who she would see as allies and who are very intent on fighting racism in Germany. I think one important thing is to make people feel that it has something to do with them, that you're not just doing something for other people, but that you yourself don't want to live in a society as a white person that is so racist. You know? And racism is a political problem and has to do with power and power distribution. Many people maybe want to personify racism, but it actually has to do also with the structures of society.
It changed with our community. ISD, it means Initiative of Black Germans and Blacks in Germany. So, and then we have once a year a big meeting all over Germany and come together, and so we talk. And we have also groups in different cities. So you see now the children, they grow up, they have own community. And that's very important. Now in Germany we have to write our own history. We have no history. We have no role models like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. So
there has been a lot of work done in the meantime on Afro-German history or history of blacks in Germany. And there's one book I can recommend. It's called Showing Our Colors, Afro-German Women Speak Out. It was the first book by Afro-Germans and gives the history from the Middle Ages to today, or to what came out in the 80s, to the 80s, and stories of different generations of women, like women who were born by German mothers and African fathers, and the fathers came in late 19th century to Germany from German colonies, and from that generation, and the generation which Ika belongs to, and then younger women from the 60s and 70s. So it's a very interesting book, it's published by the University of Massachusetts Press. And there's a third book. I'm mentioning this because it was quite an achievement to get all these books translated into English, you know, because English-speaking publishers don't easily take on translations. So there's a third book by an Afro-German woman, Mai Ayim. Her essays and some of her poetry are translated and published by Africa World Press. And there's a film on Mai Ayim's life. Mai was an excellent poet and an activist and scholar. Like the book Showing Our Colors has a lot of her historical research in it. And the film is on her life and work. She committed suicide in 1996, and we made a film on her afterwards. Most of the younger generation have African fathers who came after the liberation of the states, countries, to Germany or as students or to work. Today you find black Germans in all kinds of professions, lawyers or actors. There's an agency in Cologne, which is run by younger Afro-Germans. Yes, they facilitate jobs for young Afro-Germans who want to be actors, musicians, or what, you know. So there has been a change, especially in the media. Ika's generation at that time, you know, like the women were mainly given jobs as nurses. The attitude then was that Afro-Germans should not be in leading positions, but should be in lower positions and definitely not in any kind of manager position. Lots of the women were nurses. That has definitely changed. And what's happening in France, it's like an explosion. I mean, what set it off is the death of the two youth, but what it really shows is how inhumane and undignified young people are growing up. Today in the Deutsche Welle, the German radio station, which is the broadcast for outside of Germany, they said that this couldn't happen in Germany because in Germany the immigrants still see themselves as guests and do not have any expectations. You know, and Ika said, well, that's one way of seeing it, and the more convenient way of seeing it, but she doesn't think that that's really so. Even if, you know, France has different conditions and the communities are also bigger, but that kind of anger is there in Germany too. And like May 1st is an occasion when they're usually always in Berlin, there's violent demonstrations, Germans too, not just immigrants, but shows how that there's this deep anger, you know. Well, a lot of, you know, in terms of guests, a lot of immigrants are no longer guests, you know, but have German citizenship, you know, and see themselves, the young immigrants see themselves as Berlin Turks or German Turks or Turkish Germans, or, you know, they don't see themselves as Turkish guest workers who leave again, you know. Like, it's more the Germans who want to see them as guests. As long as you're not, can't feel welcome, then you maybe also feel as a temporary or as an outsider, you know. I mean, that's the other question, is if somebody's a guest, you usually treat them well, right?
Yeah.
We had the beginning of this reading, but I want to transition really quick for the remainder of the show to a younger generation. And I welcome Valida Imarisha on the show. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Welcome to the show. And you should be familiar to people in Portland because you lived here and you went to PSU for a while, right?
Yes, I did, for 4 years.
Okay. You also spent part of your childhood in Germany. What was your experience like?
I think my experience is probably substantially different. I lived in Germany from 8 to 14, but I grew up on military bases. My mother was in the Department of Defense, so I lived on the military base, but I actually I went to school on the military base, but we actually lived in a small farming village in Germany called Passelsheim. So we had like a field behind us and a cow farm in front of us.
And in the Ika Hugel Marshall, in her book, talks, when she talks about her experience, it becomes very clear that the racialized thinking of the Nazi period didn't just disappear with the Nazis, but a lot of that was alive and well. Did you see any of that happen?
Yeah, I think that it was definitely very racialized. I think that there's a privilege being an American that goes around the world, even if you're an American of color, even if you're a Black American. So I think that I think there's also a detriment to that as well, because there are stereotypes and racist portrayals of Black folks in America that go around the country as well. But I think that that I definitely experienced German racism, probably different than Black folks who were born in Germany or who immigrated there from different countries, because I was American and because there was this kind of coolness about it, like, oh, well, you're Black, but you are American, so, you know, you're hip-hop and you're rap and you're this culture that we, you know, are force-fed to like. So I think it's a different reality, but I definitely think that racism is still extremely, you know, alive and well around the globe in every single part of it. And I definitely think in Germany the issues have not been dealt with, but definitely in regards to immigrant populations there.
Did you have any contact with the contemporary Afro-German movement, or do you have any contact with that now, or any anything you want to relate from?
I didn't when I was there. I didn't actually even know that there were Afro-Germans when I lived there when I was 8 to 14. But I wouldn't say I have strong ties there now, but I do know one woman actually who emailed me based on some political work that I was doing around prison organizing. And she was working from Germany on a death row prisoner in Texas's case. And he had sent her my chapbook. He had just randomly gotten a hold of it, I think some of the organizing work. And she emailed me and said how moved she was and how powerful she felt that the work that I was doing is. I have one poem, Biracial Blues, which is about being mixed because my mother is white and my father is. And so she also had that experience, even though both her parents, I believe her father is an immigrant, an African immigrant. Mm-hmm. And so, but she was born in Germany. And she just emailed that and said how similar her experiences were. And it was interesting to see that connection happen across cultural lines, mm-hmm. you know, across continental and country lines.
Mm-hmm. You want to talk a little bit about your work? Not everybody may be familiar with it. And maybe announce your website.
Sure. I have a website that's called poetryoffthepage.com, poetryoffthepage.com. I do poetry and journalism, and I also do political organizing that I tie my poetry and journalism into. And a lot of the work that I do addresses issues of race. I do anti-military organizing, which directs out of growing up on military bases in places like Germany, seeing the realities of what the military looks like when it's on in someone else's country. And I think that I definitely saw a lot of American chauvinism towards people in their own countries through the GIs and the military. So that definitely colored the way that I think about the military, no pun intended. I also do anti-prison organizing. I work here in Philadelphia with the Human Rights Coalition, which is a prisoner family organization. And so we do organizing work as prisoners' families and ex-prisoners to try and change the prison system here. And I recently went down to New Orleans, actually, for a week and a half and shot footage. So I've been working on writing articles and essays based on that, talking about the amazing organizing work that people on the ground are doing in New Orleans, people who are most affected by the hurricane, which is poor people, people of color, women, queer and trans folks, really doing organizing work that's not at all being portrayed in the mainstream media. The mainstream media is telling us that, you know, we have to wait for FEMA or Red Cross to come in and save people. And my experience down there was that FEMA and Red Cross were really inept at the relief work, and they were very absent from the relief work, and it was really people from the community, volunteers from around the country, just bringing in supplies, driving it there themselves, that was saving people's lives and were giving them what they needed to rebuild. And so I've really been trying to write articles and put together a film based on supporting the work that's going on down there by the people most affected by the hurricane.
And again, I'm speaking with spoken word artist and writer Walida Imarisha. You want to give us, offer us a piece of your work?
Oh.
Have anything you're able to share?
Sure. Well, I'll just read a little piece of a poem that I actually wrote with Taria Autry, who's my poetry partner in our group Good Sister, Bad Sister, and she's actually a professor at Portland State University. And this poem is called Prison Industrial Complex, and I wrote it, we wrote it, but I was definitely writing from a place of thinking of my experiences, my adopted brother, Kekemia Jahad, who's an amazing poet and visual artist in his own right, is doing 15 to life in California, so I wrote it in the spirit of thinking about him and my experiences with him. High-density solutions to widespread problems, lives lived in irrelevance, born into circumstance because the world is rough and people are difficult enough to deal with, but separated by barbed wire and iron bars and 15-minute phone calls that are interrupted every 3 minutes so some automated voice can tell you, you are talking to an inmate, just to remind you constantly who has the power and that it isn't you. To be ripped apart by rejected letters because you didn't read the regulations close enough. To get your visit cut short because the metal detector went off arbitrarily and the guards took their time searching you. To reach across this distance of space and pain and time. Jesus, especially time, that drips off clock like spit from the mouths of rabid dogs. To carry all of this on human shoulders seems like it should be outlawed by the Constitution. Seems beyond cruel and unusual punishment. and yet so familiar as 2 million become 260 million, become all of us. Trapped by 13th Amendment loopholes, slavery, forced servitude, bondage are outlawed, except in the case of punishment. On legislative floors and ballot boxes, honest, good, upright citizens cast their vote for bigger and badder and tougher, so they can sleep at night, so they can forget, so we can forget our historical race fears, scared of our own skin sometimes, skinned of history, skimmed off of history, and beaten in the flesh of capital, where flesh becomes the capital on Wall Street stock markets and we are sweated out of ghettos to pool on street corners and finally bleed in the prison yard. While we, the people, the public consumers, are psychologically manipulated by Colgate commercials between shots of bloody murders, we begin to have Oedipal dreams about our mother country and our fatherland. Schizophrenic behavior is the norm as we realize this country has a serious prison industrial complex and getting more serious every minute. So that's just a little piece of that poem called Prison Industrial Complex.
Thank you so much. Are you coming back to Portland by any chance anytime soon?
I'm going to be going to Chiapas, Mexico to work with the Zapatistas down there with a group called Estación Libre, which is a group of people of color who do support work for the Zapatistas. So I'm just coming through Portland very briefly just to visit Chia and my other family out there and see my brother before I head down there, but I'm not actually doing any shows.
Okay. You want to repeat your website one more time for people who would like to read more?
Sure. It's poetryoffthepage.com, and I have a live journal that is linked to that, and I'm going to be doing updates on about Chiapas. So if folks are at all interested, they should definitely check it off. So it's www.poetryoffthepage.com.
Thank you so much for being on KBO.
And yeah, thank you so much.
I'll have to bring you when you come back from Chiapas to talk about you.
Definitely. That'd be beautiful.
Thanks so much.
All right. Peace.
This was Walida Imarisha, a young spoken word artist who spent part of her childhood in Germany. And before that, we heard a reading by Ika Hugel Marshall from her book Invisible Woman, Growing Up Black in Germany. That book is published in the United States by Continuum Press. And the other books mentioned in that reading, one of them was Showing Our Colors, Afro-German Women Speak Out. That was published in 1992 by the University of Massachusetts. And then May Ayim published Blues in Black and White in Africa World Press. And another interesting book is Hans Massakoi, Destined to Witness, Growing Up Black in Nazi Germany. He actually immigrated later to the United States and has become the editor of Ebony magazine. If you miss any of that, give us a call and we'll be happy to tell you about it. Thanks for listening. My name was Gabriela Ross. This was Bread and Roses on KBO 90.7 FM. And my engineer was Molly, and have a good evening.
Yeah. Willkommen zu Sisters Keepers. Und es ist egal, wo du herkommst oder wie du aussiehst, denn keiner gleicht dem anderen. Don't smile, we sure have lost.
Bravest fighting our battles in a heavy core. I know that the world could be a better place, but it seems some things will never change. If you were torn apart and don't know which path to choose, choose where the love is at, home is where your heart is at. I don't feel no vibe from you, I can see the lie with you. Don't even have the time to say, better kick around than you are.
Hi, my name is Andy. I listen to Jay's Place on KBU Radio.
It is now 7:02, and you are tuned to Jay's Place, right here on 90.7 KBU. I am glad to be back, Tom. I'm glad that you're back to see the Jay's Place. We have a great show for you lined up tonight. So stay tuned, relax, and we're going to meet James tonight. You now listen to Mr. Kim Waters and check this out.